This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Jada Del Fabbro, who is a forensic and clinical psychologist in private practice. This episode is part of our commemoration of World Mental Health Day, which was on the 10th of October. And according to the World Health Organization, one in five individuals experiences a mental health condition and emphasizes that there is no health without mental health. With that said, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I actually feel it's an honor and a privilege to be part of this initiative and your show. And thank you for having me.
You have a wonderful quote on your website. Every day we should hear at least one little song, read one good poem, see one exquisite picture, and if possible, speak a few sensible words. I think it's such sage advice. And with that said, can you please tell us about your path into psychology, what attracted you to the field, and then what led you to specialize in both clinical as well as forensic and psycholegal work?
Sure. So my path began with a quite profound curiosity about why people do what they do. So I was initially drawn to clinical psychology because of its focus on healing, resilience, and helping individuals navigate complex emotional landscapes, particularly trauma and anxiety. I eventually specialized by adding the forensic or psycholegal component because I realized that the law is often where human suffering and dysfunction intersect most dramatically. Within structured systems. So my role shifted to one of purely healing to one of sort of being an objective truth-seeking person. And this area really allows me to use my clinical skills, so interviewing, assessment, diagnosis, to answer precise legal questions. So whether it's determining fitness to stand trial, assessing parental capacity, or really looking at the emotional impact of an injury. So it's about being the interpreter between the complexity of the human mind and the formality of the courtroom.
It's such an interesting dynamic. And as I said earlier, you know, you're the first forensic psychologist we've had on the show. And having that translation and interpretation piece is so critical. Is there quite a high demand for your types of services? And are there enough of you?
So those are two very good questions, because there is a high demand and there's not enough. I think that a lot of people who enter the psychology profession, the nature of sort of the legal system and the adversarial nature, the kind of the nature of that kind of work, I think, is a deterrent to lots of psychologists going into the forensic area for a number of reasons. But also there's limits there around how much healing you can do in terms of your role. And I think if people are drawn to psychology because of predominantly the healing component, they get put off. So there's not a lot of us. And but there's definitely a huge need, and specifically a need at public service level, because right now there's no real bodies that cater to this. So it's exclusively private. And then obviously at the discretion of the practitioner around their fees and how much they charge. So it does exclude a whole bunch of people that could really benefit from a more subsidized space for it.
Mm. And can you tell us about some of the aspects that you find most rewarding around your work?
So, I mean, I think that the most rewarding part of my job is really to achieve sort of clarity and finality for people caught in difficult processes. So, I mean, one of them is bringing the child's voice. So in custody evaluations, it's providing a clear, grounded perspective on what is truly in the best interests of the child. The other part is really the objective truth. So providing objective science-backed evidence in complex legal matters, it helps the court make fair decisions, and it can bring sort of closure to victims, families, or individuals concerned. And then preventing harm. I mean, in the risk assessments I do, my work can literally help prevent future harm to individuals or communities.
When you were talking about the child's voice, often I think in those types of custody elements, you're hearing the parent's voice. So that must be really challenging, to one, hear the child's voice, and also that the child doesn't feel any guilt that they're not being pulled or pushed into one or other parent's thinking.
And that is really tricky because, I mean, the matters that come to me really can't be resolved through the channels, whether it's mediation or somebody, the family advocate. So these are often matters where the parents are very acrimonious and antagonistic towards one another. And, unfortunately, the child often gets lost in that, or the child is manipulated, or, and it can be subtle. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a concerted effort to brainwash the child, but it can be subtle in terms of children are incredibly sensitive to the kind of relationship between their parents. So, if there is verbal aggression or even just bad vibes between parents, children pick up on that, and often their behaviors or their choices can be influenced by that. So really, in terms of my assessment, it's about trying to create a space where you can assess where the child's at, and informing, the court along those lines.
You work in a very diverse space, and when I look at aspects from your website and your profile, you've got therapy, you've got medico-legal assessments, custody evaluations, and you also have teaching and supervision. How do you juggle all of these different roles?
So I think it's by design because I really enjoy all those different aspects of my field. But I think it's really about compartmentalization and boundary setting. So each role uses a different skill set. So it's about switching hats. So when I'm in therapy, I'm empathetic and focused on growth. When I'm doing a forensic assessment, then I have to be more objective, analytical, and focused on collecting reliable data. And really, my kind of role as a teacher or supervisor, it kind of allows me to step back and almost synthesize both worlds, which keeps my clinical knowledge sharp and does prevent burnout, actually. But it also helps to have good, strict scheduling. So I physically block off days for different types of works. So sort of Mondays might be reserved for forensic report writing, Tuesday and Wednesdays for therapy sessions. So it helps prevent me carrying sort of the emotional weight of one role into sort of the more cognitive demands of another.
It's really interesting that you're able to do this, but also what I think is great is the fact that you are able to exploit all of your interests in your own way and not be pigeonholed into one area.
Sure. That is 100% correct. And I really enjoy that. It's in terms of my personality and who I am, that really works for me. I think the key, though, to be able to do that effectively is in terms of what I've spoken about, in terms of compartmentalization, because whereas empathy is a good skill, even in the forensic work, it can't cloud your objectivity in certain ways, So I think it's important to realize what hat you're wearing in which
Yeah.
situation.
And pull out the right toolbox or the
That's
tool out
right.
of the
That
right
is
tool
right.
out of the box.
That's right.
When I was looking at your website, You've got some interesting things there, I must say. I read, for example, that you had participated in a panel about Steinheist, and part of your contribution was on the topic of psychopathic behavior with a great expression there, snakes in suits, and that there are more of these characters than I think we realize who literally deceive people. But as someone who practices in this field and has experience, what are some of the red flags that we should be on the lookout for?
Really, when you look at sort of a psychopathy or things like that, the constellation is really around manipulative, charm-driven, and unethical behaviors. So the keyword here is deceit. But the red flags to look out for is sort of a superficial charm and really grandiose sense of self. So they are immediately likable. They're often charismatic and really smooth talkers. So they present as highly confident, sometimes almost too perfect, and they have an exaggerated sense of self-worth or achievement. Then the second one would really be pathological lying and lack of remorse. So they lie effortlessly, like even when saying the truth would be enough. But especially when they're caught in a lie or when their actions hurt someone, then they display a complete lack of guilt or shame. They'll often blame the victim or external circumstances. And then the third one would really be manipulation and a parasitic lifestyle. So they really view others as tools to be used, not as full human beings with thoughts and feelings of their own. They exploit relationships, whether it's professional or personal, for financial gain, status, or power. And they often leave a trail of sort of exhausted and financially damaged people behind them. So that all sounds lovely, but that is really what you're looking at.
Thing that fascinates me is how they manage to keep doing this almost without getting caught, and that they've left this trail of destruction behind them, and yet we still take them into our confidences.
And I think it's because of that charm. And I think the extent of the confidence that is put forward makes you almost question yourself for questioning them. So it's that. And I think as they lack empathy or remorse, they're very good at reading people. So it's not that they don't know what. They can't understand how other people work and what they might feel. They do, and they exploit that. So they'll basically put on whatever mask is necessary to get what they want out of you. So that's why they can succeed for quite a long period of time.
Fascinating. And I don't think there's a recovery. I think that's who they are
No,
fundamentally.
it's there's none. There's not. I mean, I can say that categorically.
Earlier we spoke about your ability to, well, part of your role in bringing out the child's voice in custody battles. And I wanted to ask you, in your experience with custody battles, what are some of the most common challenges that mothers face in these types of disputes? And also, do you think that there's still a bias in the legal system when it comes to awarding custody?
So, I mean, in my experience, the legal system has become a bit more gender neutral in theory. So they focus on the primary caregiver principle and the child's best interest. But challenges and sort of subtle biases are still there. So I think the common challenges for mothers is the financial strain. So historically, mothers may have interrupted their careers, creating a power imbalance when facing fathers with higher incomes who can sort of afford prolonged litigation. And then this whole idea of the gatekeeper narrative. So often mothers who express valid concerns about safety or conflict can sometimes be unfairly labeled as gatekeepers and be accused of trying to alienate the child from the other parent. And I think the other thing that you find is there is still a subtle bias in the system where kind of the definition of stability. So, if a mother's seen as highly emotional, or if her mental health is an issue, it can be scrutinized more intensely than other factors. So, often due to outdated cultural expectations and sort of around maternal composure and sacrifice. So in terms of decisions, I don't think it's sort of default to the mom in terms of primary residence. I think predominantly that is looked at as, I think they do go that way, but there has been a shift where there is more consideration given to, the father would be a better option in terms of primary caregiver.
Okay. It's interesting to see how things have shifted in some situations, but not in others. And tying into that view of perhaps women may express themselves a little bit more emotionally, that when a woman's health, mental health is brought into question in these types of scenarios, it can sometimes be used against her. How can women protect themselves under unfair biases? And I say this because you know what? I mean, these are not normal circumstances. And you are potentially not behaving in your typical way because of the emotion and the stress that it brings out.
And needless to say, I think even if any parent, either parent or any of the caregivers have got mental health difficulties, it's not so much about the present, it's about, well, how are they managing that so that it doesn't impact negatively on the child. So the existence of that is not by default a negative mark. It's about saying, okay, that's fine, but are you taking a medication? Are you seeing a psychiatrist? Are you seeing a therapist? And how much is the child impacted by it? But okay, so I think when a woman's mental health is scrutinized in court, it's sort of critical to focus on functions, not feelings. So if you are seeking mental health support, I think it's important for you as a woman to kind of disclose and have early and honest documentation. So ensure that you seeking mental health support is documented by a licensed registered psychologist, and focus on how the treatment improves your functioning as a parent, not just how it alleviates distress. And I think it's important to differentiate distress from impairment. So it's normal to feel distress, anxiety, sadness, frustration, especially during a divorce, as you've just mentioned. So a woman must be prepared to articulate that while she is distressed, it does not equal functional impairment in her capacity to be a parent, maintain boundaries, or care for the child. And I think it's, sometimes it's like, for example, my role, if I'm engaged, then I use a mix of assessment tools, psychometrics. So, and psychometrics will tell you that beyond the distress factor and the situation of the divorce, what is this person's personality? What are their strengths and weaknesses? So, as much as you may be presenting emotionally, well, do your psychometrics show that you've got emotional dysregulation problems? Or do collateral sources like work colleagues, friends describe you as kind of an off the head, like fly off the handle kind of person? Well, can they confirm that this is not how you usually are? So I think that also helps, having sort of a neutral expert to focus on capacity and resilience, not just the diagnosis.
And in a way, it goes back to what you were saying about some of your own work of how you can compartmentalize different elements. So you can't just equate feeling with function. You can split them out.
Yeah, completely.
And whilst we're on the topic of mental health, I understand that there isn't a single trigger that causes flare-ups or problems. And the reality is that no one is immune. It could be an environmental factor, it could be genetic, it could be biological. So, in your practice and experience, what would you say are some of the most common mental health challenges that you've seen among women?
So, I think one of them is sort of the anxiety perfectionism trap. So, high achieving women often present with severe anxiety, sort of rooted in perfectionism and sort of the pressure to excel in every sphere, whether it be career, mother, partner, etc. I also see a lot of maternal burnout and identity loss. So, I see significant challenges when women lose their sense of self, like post motherhood, which can lead to burnout, depression, or an identity crisis in midlife when children leave home, or later in life. I mean, these days we don't know when children leave home. And then I see relational trauma. So sort of trauma from relational issues, past or present abuse, sort of infidelities, or difficult family dynamics. And, you know, this is quite pervasive and it often manifests as complex post-traumatic stress disorder, difficulty trusting, and self-worth issues.
Three very different areas, and I imagine that there is an extent of intersectionality between them at times.
Sure, of course.
And when women are experiencing challenges, so for instance, burnout, as being one of those aspects, what strategies or mindsets or mind shifts could they adopt to deal with their situation?
So, I mean, I think the first step really is to shift from being about doing to being. So those two verbs.
Please explain that a bit more, doing to being.
So, and shift your sort of internal dialogue. Okay. So it's really about, instead of defining yourself by what you do, allow yourself to just be. So I think the mindset we're looking at is to adopt sort of radical self-compassion. So women are often their own harshest critics. I mean, and I think it's about encouraging replacing critical self-talk with kindness and sort of non-judgmental acceptance. Like I often say, talk to yourself like you would talk to your best friend. You know, and I think that's a good thought experiment. and just accept that like failure is just information and a sign that you can do things differently. I think the other part is to set non-negotiable boundaries. So burnout happens often when we allow our personal resources to be depleted. So it's about identifying your top three non-negotiables. For example, maybe you want a quiet half hour every morning. You want to say no to late night emails. Just a specific time to switch off and treat them like appointments you're making with yourself. And then I think the other part is to connect with your body more. So stress is stored physically, trauma is stored physically. And I think movement is important. So it doesn't have to be intense exercise. It could just be gentle stretching, breath work, you know, just dancing in your living room. And it just helps discharge nervous energy and just reconnects the mind and the body.
And given what you're saying, and I know that it's the world that we live in, it's as though we're always on.
Yeah. Completely.
And taking that thought a little further and in that always on space, I don't think there is a field or a discipline that artificial intelligence
Yeah.
hasn't touched. And could you give us a couple of examples of how it's impacted your field?
So, I mean, I think there are positives and negatives, like with anything. I mean, I think a common growing use for artificial intelligence in our field is it's quite good at sort of NLP, so natural language processing. So it really helps with research synthesis and document efficiency. So, for example, AI can transcribe long forensic or clinical interviews, and then it uses can use that to analyze huge amounts of text data to sort of identify patterns in language usage, which you can see as deception, trauma markers, or cognitive function. So it does help speed up the report drafting process and allows the psychologist to spend less time on admin and more time on sort of the high-level clinical reasoning. So in a way, it's quite good at sort of analyzing large data sets and helping you with that. It also kind of helps access to care. So what we've seen is that AI-driven chatbots or structured apps, it can provide like basic immediate support to people maybe in remote areas that can't get to a human therapist or can't necessarily afford one. The pitfalls are that if AI is trained in data from a particular socio-cultural group or socio-economic background, its output can be biased. So it can lead to unfair assessments or evaluations for diverse populations. And then if you're feeding information into it, you need to keep that in mind around what it provides. I think also there's sort of what the black box problem, which is if clinicians over rely on AI and their recommendations without understanding why it came to that conclusion, it can sort of lose, you can lose a critical human-led judgment decision-making component, which is crucial, in especially the psycholegal work that I do. And I think there's sort of an erosion of rapport. So in therapy, the human element, sort of trust, empathy, connection, it's the core mechanism of change. So if you bring AI too much into it, it can really dehumanize the process. And I think what I've found is what's been concerning is that a lot of patients ask ChatGPT for advice on everything. And without the I don't think it's a I think it's a very intelligent resource, but I think that doesn't have access to the history, the information, the reports that you have as a therapist and know what this person's, and so its recommendations can be could actually sometimes put the patient at more risk, because if it's overly supportive of that person's thinking or decision making, it can lead them to make not so beneficial decisions.
It reminds me a bit like the Dr. Google scenario.
Yes, yeah.
And when you look at, when you put your symptoms into the tool, it's like, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this. Then you go to your doctor and they say, well, actually, no, you've got none of these. It is X.
Yeah. Completely. So, I'm a bit concerned about that.
Yeah. But thanks for sharing your views as an expert in your field and looking at some of the pitfalls as well as the advantages of the tool in its
Sure.
current iteration. And now what I'd like to talk about is thinking about your career and looking at it from a point of view of potentially encouraging younger people to consider forensic psychology. So, if you could tell us in general, how female-friendly would you say forensic psychology is?
So I think they are highly female friendly. In South Africa and globally, women significantly outnumber men in the field of clinical and forensic psychology. It's a field that does highly value empathy, exceptional communication, meticulous attention to detail, and sort of analytical rigor, which are skills where women often excel. You see, the only caveat is really that, like all trauma-exposed fields, it requires strong self-care and professional supervision to manage the emotional toll of the work.
And on that piece, because it's the first time it's been raised, tell us what do you do to debrief? Is it about speaking to or having appointments with other psychologists, or how do you do that?
Sure. So there's sort of, there can be peer supervision where you touch base with a colleague and say, look, I'm dealing with this, I'm struggling with this, what are your thoughts? And there's professional supervision where you will, have a space where you can debrief with another psychologist. You can also have your own therapy space, and that's highly recommended, where you can process some of the emotions that come up for you in the work that you're doing. So I think all those aspects are vital. And kind of a professional supervisor can help keep you on track around your judgment, kind of tip. A sounding board to test your thoughts around a certain case. But I think the role of a therapist is vital, because I think that's where you can release and process the emotions that come up for you in the work.
I think it's so interesting that there's this sort of iterations, and it's not the right word, but just how you make use of your own discipline for
Yes,
yourself in your
sure.
own work. So, what would your message be for young women who are considering a career in psychology in general?
So it's quite a simple one. I would say sort of do it with integrity and never stop learning. So, I mean, psychology is fascinating because it's a science, it's an art, and it's also a profound responsibility. So it's about be curious, be compassionate, be resilient. The people that work with you, be sharing that you work with, will be sharing their most vulnerable stories. So honor that by constantly updating your knowledge, looking for mentorship, and most importantly, investing as much time in your own mental health as you do in that of others.
And if you had a chance to do something differently in your career, what would that be, and how would you approach it knowing what you know now?
So, I mean, I think it definitely would be mastering the business and admin side of a practice much better. And I think when you start out, you train to be a good clinician, an assessor, but not necessarily an entrepreneur or a manager. So I'd approach it now by sort of seeking out maybe formal business coaching, mentorship from established successful practitioners to sort of be able to build a sustainable and efficient practice model from day one.
It's so true what you're saying, because you're trained in as being a clinician, but at the same time, you have to learn how to operate your business in order to work effectively.
And I mean, I learned that lesson much later on. But I think it's such a key one, kind of to learn those skills as well.
Okay. And one question that I ask all my guests on the show is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. So some people will speak about another person in their life, or perseverance, or values, faith. In your opinion, what would you say have been some of the key drivers to your success?
So I think the first one would be discipline over motivation. So like motivation is fleeting, but discipline is the habit you build every day. So it's the discipline to write the difficult report, to show up on time, to read the research. So that's definitely one. I think the second one really is self-awareness, so the emotional intelligence. So knowing your own biases, my own limitations, my emotional triggers, it's essential, especially in an objective field like forensic work. You can't sort of help others if you can't accurately assess yourself. And I think the other one is I've got quite a strong ethical compass. So my values, as you mentioned, sort of truth, objectivity, compassion, they guide every decision. So when I'm facing complex ethical dilemmas in the work that I do, I think if I come back to those values, then it helps me act with integrity and sort of prioritize the best outcome for the vulnerable individuals that are involved.
And how do you improve on your on self-awareness? Because, as you said, if you know what your blind spots are, if you know where your biases are, that helps you in your role.
So, I mean, I think that's therapy helps with that. And I also think it's important to reflect on perhaps why you do the things you do, or why are you thinking the things you're thinking about something. And are you sticking to the facts at hand, or are you sort of going off on your own tangent? And that might give you a sense of what it might be evoking in you that you could project onto the situation. But I think it is about sort of processes like journaling. If that I think that that's that helps me a lot, journaling about what's coming up for me, why I'm feeling what I'm feeling. Is it about personal stuff? Is it professional stuff? So that kind of thing. It definitely helps sort through the feelings I'm having. and also to just have done enough self-exploration and work in whatever. It doesn't have to be in therapy. Therapy would be great, but it can be through, there's literature out there that can guide you. Some really great clinicians that have written work that can help you get a better sense of yourself. So it's about spending time to really get to know yourself.
So interesting, thinking about yourself as a friend in a way, with some of the things that you've expressed today. And growing up, what would you say have been pivotal moments in your life?
So I think, I think growing up, I was always fascinated with crime stories, like even as a kid. So Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys. So there's always this fascination with how why people do there was definitely the investigative analytical component was there, and sort of also this fascination with, kind of solving mysteries. And I think in a way, a lot of my work is kind of doing that in some ways. But I think I've always been compassionate. I mean, I think I was taught that and empathy quite young, by my mother, my father, family I grew up in. There was a lot of care and love, and I think that that has definitely helped me, well, definitely nurtured that in myself. So, kind of feeds into my work. But I also grew up sort of seeing how people's life stories sort of shape their reality and their outcomes. So I think I was always fascinated with people's history, sort of, and where they came from, and that really understanding them meant sort of understanding where they came from and sort of getting their full story. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's strange. At the time, I didn't realize it, but looking back, I think in a way, the therapist in me was there from very early on.
And think about that kind of like path dependence of what makes people who they are today. Do you think they've got this opportunity of being able to change and redirect their future, or does the history keep pushing them into a particular direction?
It all depends, because I think there's obviously scars that one cannot just change the narrative around and not have and impact your life. But I do think for a lot of people it is. I think you do have the capacity to change the narrative. It's hard and it's not sort of instant, and I think it maybe have to done like small bite-sized pieces. But I definitely think one doesn't have to be defined by one's past in terms of the decisions that one makes for this future. If you can develop enough awareness to understand how that can happen.
So there's no control alt delete.
No, no. At least we go back to lobotomies, but that's been outlawed ages ago.
Lastly, as we close out today's show, please share a few words of inspiration or motivation you'd like to pass on to girls and women who are listening to us.
Think. I mean, your voice is your power. I think that's really what I want to say. I mean, we live in a continent of like profound resilience with and wisdom and incredible beauty. So I would say to young women and girls, like, don't let outdated narratives or external pressure really limit how ambitious you can be. So prioritize education, prioritize emotional health. Look for mentors who see your potential, not your limitations. And I mean, because everyone, your whatever your unique perspective is, it's really needed to solve some of the greatest challenges of our time. So really be brave, be kind to yourself, and yeah, never hesitate to sort of step into your full potential. That would be what I'd say.
Fantastic message. I love that expression. Your voice is your power. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being, having a conversation with you.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Jada Del Fabbro, who is a forensic and clinical psychologist in private practice.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.